diver.
It didn't take long before Sugden felt Tiger was ready to transition from the pool to dive master, a term reserved for divers just beneath the instructor level. In a little over a year, becoming qualified to lead other certified divers on dives. Before long, the ocean became his biggest passion. The ocean floor was the one place on Earth where no one recognized him and no one wanted anything from him. Alone among the fish, he once confided to a friend, he felt more at peace than he did anywhere else. After returning home from the British Open, Tiger took off for the Bahamas and disappeared beneath the sea. In addition to exploring coral reefs, he also took advantage of the opportunity to sharpen control over his nerves. When he encountered a giant fish, he learned how not to let his heart rate go up. This skill went a long way toward allowing him to control his heart rate when he had to make a crucial putt. While Woods sought refuge in the ocean, Tiger mania reached a fervor that surpassed even the frenzied aftermath of his 1997 Masters win. In mid-August, he simultaneously appeared on the cover of Time and was the subject of a 12-page profile in The New Yorker titled The Chosen One. American Express aired a commercial, Tiger Woods in Manhattan, showing him blasting golf balls through Central Park, over the Brooklyn Bridge, and down the middle of Wall Street. And everyone on the tour, players, caddies, swing coaches, recognized that Tiger had established himself as the best, or damn close to it, in every single aspect of the game. Driving, ball striking, short game, putting, scoring, he didn't have a weakness. By the time he showed up at the PGA Championship at Valhalla Golf Club in Louisville at the end of August, some of the top caddies thought Tiger had become so good that it was unfair. Things had reached a point where everybody was intimidated by him. Even seasoned pros were unnerved when paired with him, especially on Sunday. But after leading throughout the tournament and entering the final round atop the leaderboard at 13 under par, Woods was paired with a man who was not intimidated. To most golf fans, the name Bob May meant little, but Tiger knew him well. In the mid-80s, May had been the best junior golfer in Southern California. Woods was 10 at the time and had already won 2 junior world titles, and he studied the junior golf rankings the way some kids memorize the stats on the back of baseball cards. May had never won a major championship on the PGA Tour, but the 31-year-old was ranked 48th in the world and was an exceptional iron player. Tied for second, he was just one shot behind Woods. At the start of the round, Tiger turned to Steve Williams and whispered, "This guy won't back down." May had spent a sleepless Saturday night in his hotel room telling himself over and over, "Play the course, not the man. You can't control what Woods is doing. He's the longest hitter in the world. He's going to play a different course than you. Play the golf course. It's the only thing you can do." It all felt right to May until Woods stepped up to the first tee, a dog leg left known as cut the corner, and unleashed a missile over a 60-foot-tall stand of trees as if they were shrubs. When the ball finally stopped rolling, it was at least 50 yards past May's drive. To the sold-out gallery, it looked like today would be another walk in the park for Tiger. Surely this guy May would fold under the pressure. Instead, one of the classic duels in major championship history unfolded. At the end of regulation, Woods and May stood tied at a PGA championship record 18 under par. Both men had shot 31 on the back nine, each contributing to a highlight reel of extraordinary shot-making and clutch putts. On the final hole, Woods had faced a treacherous 8-foot putt to extend the match and possibly collect his third straight major. After draining it, he turned to Williams and said, "Stevie, my mom could have made that putt. I'm Tiger Woods. I'm supposed to make that putt. It ain't no big deal, Stevie." May felt the same thing. No big deal. Given the stakes, he was playing the best round of golf in his life. A final round 65, and he had a chance to win, especially after Tiger pushed his second drive of the 3-hole playoff deep into a cluster of trees. For any other golfer on the PGA Tour, the only option was a low-risk chip-out back onto the fairway and an almost guaranteed bogey. But Tiger's creative mind imagined something else entirely. A punched 8-iron bullet under the trees and onto a cart path where it bounced over the rough and rolled into a swale behind the green. Off the cart path, May was so stunned that he wondered whether Tiger had done that intentionally. He had. And moments later, after he parred the last two playoff holes to edge May by a single stroke, Woods joined Ben Hogan as the only player in history to win three professional major tournaments in a single season. In a breathtaking 9-week span, Woods had won the U.S. Open, the British Open, and the PGA Championship, completing what golf writers universally consider the greatest summer in the history of the sport. The only thing as remarkable as Tiger's trifecta was the fact that his father wasn't around to witness any of it. The father who never missed his son's major championships was nowhere to be found, yet Earl still managed to draw attention to himself by criticizing Venus and Serena Williams in Sports Illustrated. 2 weeks before Tiger's victory at the British Open, 20-year-old Venus had also made history by winning Wimbledon, joining Althea Gibson, who won it in 1957 and 58, as the only African-American women to do so. In a moment of youthful exuberance, Williams had bounced up and down on the court and then gone into the stands, climbing over spectators to embrace her 18-year-old sister, Serena, the reigning U.S. Open champion, and her father, Richard Williams, who had taught his daughters the game. The Williams sisters' rise in the world of tennis had some notable parallels to Tiger's ascent. In addition to the obvious race corollary, there was the presence of a controversial father whose unusual methods sometimes caused awkward and embarrassing moments. With Tiger and Venus simultaneously making headlines on both sides of the Atlantic, Earl Woods was asked if he had ever met Richard Williams. "I've never met him, and I don't want to meet him," Earl said. "I don't think much of the way he's handling his daughters. He's not allowed them to reach their full potential. He's not allowed them to have competent professional instruction. It's almost like watching Tiger play if he'd never gone to Butch Harmon. I heard Venus say, after winning Wimbledon, 'I get to buy myself a watch.' I thought, how sad. 20 years old? Now I can buy a watch? All you have to do is listen to them. You can hear the girlish attitude and the girlish conduct. These girls are not on the road to maturity. They're in a time warp. I feel sorry for them." Earl made these comments at a time when he had essentially disappeared from Tiger's side. His absence at all three major championships fueled speculation that there had been a falling out between him and Tiger. "I raised Tiger to leave me," Earl said in 2000, adding, "We don't have to communicate with each other to validate our relationship." Earl always had an answer, but this one didn't add up, especially since he'd given a different explanation to a different reporter that summer. "I don't go to tournaments anymore because I get mobbed and can't see any golf." The real reason for Earl's sudden absence during the crowning moments of his son's career was much more complicated. It started with the fact that Tiger had spent his entire life seeking his father's approval, and he had always shared the stage with Earl. By 2000, Tiger was his own man, weary of some of Earl's antics and no longer interested in sharing the stage with him or anyone else. At the same time, Earl was no longer making any effort to camouflage his vices. He had no intention of tempering his drinking, nor was he cutting back on smoking, despite his heart problems and the warnings from his doctor. It had long aggravated Tiger that his father failed to curtail his nicotine intake despite his heart condition. A couple of years earlier, at a private dinner, Earl pulled out a cigarette, only to have Tiger take it, crush it in his hand, and toss it in an ashtray. He then bent over and whispered in Earl's ear, "Knock this stuff off, Pop. I need you." But there were much bigger issues. It had been 4 years since Tita had moved out, and Earl had filled the void by hiring a bevy of women, mostly blondes and brunettes, most of whom were young enough to be Tiger's sister to service his needs. As the president of ETW Corp, Earl had his own executive assistant. He also had a personal assistant, traveling assistant, foundation assistant, cook, personal trainer, dog trainer, massage therapist, housekeeper, and even a pedicurist. According to one of them, a few of these women were employed by Tiger's corporation, but some were not and were paid in cash, their unspoken job description to do whatever it took to please Earl. Tiger, by this time, was well aware that his father had repeatedly been unfaithful to his mother over the years. Plenty of other people associated with the PGA Tour had also begun to assume as much. As early as 1998, Earl had stopped trying to be discreet about his interest in other women. That year, he brought a younger woman with him to the President's Cup in Australia. But by 2000, Earl had largely stopped showing up at tour events, and the scene at Tiger's childhood home had gotten out of hand. Women came and went. Pornography played steadily on the television. Sex toys were stuffed in drawers, and sexual favors were performed at Earl's request. It was a house of horrors, recalled a former employee. Every drawer, every cabinet. Tiger typically called ahead when he was coming to town to visit Earl, and the women always cleaned the place up before he arrived. By now, he had a complicated view of his father, but he would never let anyone know how he really felt inside. It was as if there was some deep scarring in there that he didn't want anyone to see. Not even his father, whom he so often referred to as his best friend. In 2000, Tiger was no longer afraid to say he was too busy to take a call from Earl. And when he changed his cell phone number, which he frequently did, Earl was no longer the first person to get the new number. Tiger's silence wounded Earl. "My dad and I don't talk as much," Woods said in the midst of his historic run. "He's doing his thing, I'm doing my thing." Although Tiger was spending a lot more time with his mother and his girlfriend, he went to see Earl shortly after winning the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. When he arrived, he found his childhood bedroom virtually unchanged. The Obi-Wan Kenobi poster still hung on his closet door, and his list of Jack Nicklaus's achievements remained on the wall. Yet the environment in the house had changed. The only sign of Tita, for example, were the containers of food and pre-cut fruit that she would deliver for Earl a couple of times a week. At 68, Earl was badly overweight and spent most of his time in his chair. Tiger got him out of the house by taking him to nearby Big Canyon Country Club in Newport Beach, which had made Tiger an honorary member. There were a lot of personal things they could have discussed that day, such as the way a husband treats his wife, but how many sons are willing to go there with their fathers? In a quiet moment on the course, Earl did bring up one question. "Do you want me to be around more?" "I'll be all right, Pop," Tiger said. Earl got the message. Chapter 19. Cold. 1 week after winning the 2000 PGA Championship, Tiger found himself on the 18th fairway at the famed Firestone Country Club in Akron, Ohio. It was the final round of the WGC NEC Invitational, and Tiger was running away with the tournament. With just one hole to play, the outcome had been long decided. The only question was whether Tiger could actually find the 18th green. Earlier, storms had forced a 3-hour stoppage in play, delaying the finish. By the time play continued, a foggy gloaming had set in, obscuring the flag waiting some 167 yards away. Visibility was so poor, and the fog hung so low, that Woods had to crouch down to the ground to gauge the lie. To reach his goal of finishing 21 under par, Tiger would literally have to take a shot in the dark. He had grown up playing in the twilight with his dad, often finishing his final 2 or 3 holes in the dark. But this was Firestone, not the Navy course back home. The situation was a perfect metaphor for this stage of Tiger's career. Mere mortals were no longer a challenge. He was competing against the gods now, Mother Nature herself. Woods lived for these moments. There were chances to put his entire artistry on display. With crickets chirping and fans in the gallery holding up flickering lighters, Tiger took dead aim with an 8-iron. A flurry of camera flashes from around the 18th hole created a strobe effect as his ball fell from the darkened sky and landed 2 feet from the hole, igniting a thunderous roar that echoed down the fairway. "How about that?" he said, grinning and slapping hands with Steve Williams, then walked toward the green, holding his putter in the air as if it were a scepter and he a king. For folks watching on television, the scene was so surreal that it was tempting to wonder if the shot was a make-believe television stunt. Even the CBS broadcasters couldn't believe their eyes. "You can't do that," analyst Lanny Watkins cried out. "That can't happen." "I don't believe it," added Jim Nance. Moments later, Tiger tapped in his birdie putt to finish at 21 under par, the lowest score in tournament history and 11 strokes ahead of his nearest competitors. It was his 8th PGA Tour victory of the year. 14 days later, Tiger was again on the 72nd hole in fading light, only this time he was clinging to a one-shot lead in the final round of the Canadian Open at Glen Abbey outside Toronto. Thanks to an errant tee shot, he found himself in the middle of a yawning bunker. 213 yards from the flag, trees right, and virtually nothing but a huge body of water standing between him and the green. In Shakespearean terms, if the shot in the dark at Firestone was Hamlet, what happened next? A flushed 6-iron over 200 yards of water landing 2 feet past the pin was Macbeth. Another towering accomplishment. These shots were so dramatic that they easily overshadowed the aspect of Tiger's personality that most accounted for his outlier status, his mind. During his epic run of major championship victories and jaw-dropping shots from the latter part of 1999 through the end of 2000, Tiger's concentration day in and day out was so focused on making shots that it's difficult to put into words. It's best illustrated by a sequence that took place at the Canadian Open just moments before Tiger hit the miraculous 6-iron over water. For his tee shot on 18, there was total silence as he began his backswing. Then, right in the middle of his downswing, a fan shouted, "Tiger!" In that instant, Tiger brought his 125-mile-per-hour club head speed to a screeching halt, freezing his driver just inches from the ball. No one else in the world could stop his driver so close to the ball. His mental control over his physical abilities was unparalleled. At this point, it hardly mattered that he walked away with another win and simultaneously held the U.S., British, and Canadian Open titles. Every week, a fresh form of genius seemed to emerge. Having already sped past the career Grand Slam at age 24, the youngest in history to do it, he had far surpassed what he had done in 1999. Everyone on the PGA Tour knew that if Tiger played his best, and they played their best, Tiger would win. More important, Tiger knew that they knew it. "He's limitless," Mark Steinberg said at the time. "He's a transcendent athlete, finally being recognized as the greatest on the planet, and he has anywhere from 20 to 40 years left." In a fevered attempt to leverage Tiger's success, Steinberg was in the process of reevaluating all existing contracts with Woods' corporate partners. In 2000, Tiger earned an estimated $54 million from endorsements. To put that in context, the most that Michael Jordan ever made off the court in a single year at that point was $45 million. But Steinberg believed that Tiger was worth still more, much, much more, especially when it came to Nike. Woods was now the most photographed athlete, perhaps even the most photographed entertainer in the world. And Nike was the only brand that was visible on Tiger in all of those photographs. Even when he appeared in commercials for other companies, he always wore Nike, from the hat on his head to the shirt on his back to the shoes on his feet. Tiger was a walking billboard for the swoosh. In Steinberg's mind, that made the endorsement all-encompassing in a way that Woods' first Nike contract didn't adequately reward. Steinberg was also well aware that the company was benefiting from what Nike insiders like to call the halo effect, Tiger's significant impact on Nike products beyond golf. The two sides had been negotiating a new deal for 18 months, and in mid-September of 2000, they finally came to an agreement on a $100 million endorsement contract. It was the richest deal of its kind in the history of sports. "A lot of people have compared Tiger to Michael Jordan," said Bob Wood, the president of Nike Golf. "But one thing that makes them different is that the career of a professional golfer is so much longer than the career of a basketball player. The earning power of a professional golfer is far greater over the course of a lifetime. We're looking forward to extending our relationship with Tiger over the duration of his career, which will extend for the next 20 to 25 years and beyond." It was clear that Nike had come around to Steinberg's way of thinking and was going all in. The company also hoped that Tiger would lead its charge into the hyper-competitive golf equipment business. Bob Wood knew that the first groups on the golf course early on Saturday mornings, the low handicappers and influencers at their clubs, didn't talk about their shirt or shoes on the first tee. They talked about their driver and ball. Tiger's switch to the tour accuracy ball at Pebble Beach had given Nike instant credibility among the 5 million or so hardcore players in the U.S. and millions more around the world, and tens of thousands of pro shops and retail accounts that had previously been reluctant to embrace a shoe company with a limited foothold in the sport were now interested in Nike's ball and equipment. Just a couple of years earlier, in the fall of 1998, Nike's nascent golf business had been losing about $30 million a year on about $130 million in sales. Prior to Woods' record-setting win at the U.S. Open in 2000, Less than 15 players in an average 156-man field were playing with solid construction balls. But after Pebble Beach, virtually everybody on the tour wanted to try the Nike ball. Tiger had single-handedly broken Titleist's long-standing stranglehold. Suddenly, Nike found the door to a potential 10, 12, or even 15% market share to be wide open. Similarly, Tiger's other partners, General Motors, American Express, General Mills, were all willing to bend over backward to keep him happy. Even the Walt Disney Company, which almost never hired celebrities or athletes to endorse its products, was preparing a 5-year, $22.5 million offer to entice Tiger to appear in commercials for the company's theme parks, as well as to endorse merchandise and make appearances on Disney's ABC and ESPN channels. Tiger's halo effect was also clearly evident on the PGA Tour's negotiations with its network partners and tournament sponsors. When Woods turned pro in 1996, total purses amounted to $68 million per year. By 2001, the number had swelled to $175 million. In 2003, it would jump to $225 million. But perhaps the biggest indication of Tiger's ability to draw ratings was the Monday night golf matchups that IMG had put together with ABC Sports. The second installment, billed as the Battle at Bighorn, pitted Tiger against Sergio Garcia at the luxurious Bighorn Golf Club in Palm Desert, California near the end of the 2000 season. The head-to-head contest drew a Nielsen rating of 7.6, the highest in the series. Remarkably, nearly 8 million viewers tuned in on a Monday night in late August to watch Garcia and Woods compete in prime time. But when Garcia edged Tiger by a single shot to claim the $1 million prize, Woods was so upset that the future of the series was in jeopardy. Losing out on $1 million was one thing. The blow was softened by his guaranteed $1 million appearance fee. But Tiger didn't like for his status to be threatened. The last thing he wanted was to give Garcia the slightest hope that he could beat him when it counted on Sunday in a major. So he told IMG's Barry Frank, the creator of Monday Night Golf, that he was done, finished, quitting the series. Frank had played more than his fair share of hardball at negotiating tables around the world. He knew bullshit when he heard it, and this was no bullshit. Woods was the drawing card. Without him, Monday Night Golf was history. But Frank hadn't negotiated record-breaking rights deals without having a flair for the dramatic and knowing how to keep a card or two in his back pocket. He played those cards now with Woods and Team Tiger. What about a change in format, Frank suggested. Mix teams? Four ball instead of match play? That way, he told Woods, if you don't win, it's not your fault. Eventually, Tiger agreed to a new format that ensured none of his rivals would have a chance to beat him one-on-one in prime time. The next year, Tiger and Annika Sorenstam edged David Duval and Carrie Webb in 19 holes. Then in 2002, Tiger and Jack Nicklaus defeated Garcia and Lee Trevino 3-2. On it went. IMG and ABC profited, and so did Tiger. Over the course of 7 years of Monday night golf matches, Frank estimated that Tiger earned at least $10 million in prize money and guarantees from the show. Frank never expected to be loved by Tiger, but he wanted to be liked, and more than anything, to be respected. In an interview at his home in Connecticut in the summer of 2015, Frank made clear that Woods had never been unkind or rude, and never owed him anything. But at the same time, Frank said they had never shared what he called an intimate moment, such as a celebratory drink or lunch, and Woods had never once offered a single word of thanks for everything Frank had done for him. Sitting on the back deck of his sprawling ranch home, Frank was asked if Woods respected him. A long pause ensued before Frank, who was celebrating his 83rd birthday, answered. No, he finally said. I think I was just another Jew doing what he was paid to do, but I owed him more than he owed me. It was no surprise that the 2000 season ended with Tiger earning every conceivable honor and award, including being named Sports Illustrated's coveted Sportsman of the Year for the second time in 5 years. This time, the magazine's profile was written by Frank DeFord, who was considered a legend of sports journalism, and was considered the first sports writer to be awarded the National Humanities Medal. A colleague once referred to him this way: Frank DeFord with a pen in his hand is like Michael Jordan with a basketball and Tiger Woods with a driver. With pen in hand, DeFord made this observation about Woods at the end of his brilliant year. Tiger is such an extraordinary champion and so widely admired that we have granted him a sort of spiritual amnesty. His persona is still insulated by his deeds, his misjudgments by his youth. Sometime soon, though, we will weary of the tedium of his persistent success and start peering more deeply into that heavenly smile and those steely eyes, won't we? At that time, the only person peering deeply into Tiger's steely eyes was Joanna Jagoda. Earlier in the year, rumors had circulated that they were getting engaged, a prospect Woods quickly shot down when the golf writer raised it. "It's not true," Tiger said. "I'm here to tell you that right now. Let's put an end to this crap right now." Jagoda remained at Tiger's side as he won his 3 major championships during the summer. But in the fall of 2000, she went her own way, enrolling in law school at Pepperdine and quietly disappearing from Tiger's life. Months later, it became public knowledge that they had split. After law school, Jagoda went to work for Bear Stearns & Co., Inc., before joining J.P. Morgan Chase, where she rose to the position of vice president and assistant general counsel. Jagoda has never publicly discussed her relationship with Tiger or what prompted their breakup. But by all accounts, everyone who was close to Tiger at that time, Mark and Alicia O'Mara, Butch Harmon, Mark Steinberg, and others, adored her. She had, in many ways, the perfect temperament for Woods. In public, she always conducted herself with grace and dignity, interacting affably with everyone from officials and fellow golfers on the PGA Tour to Tiger's corporate partners. A conservative dresser who smiled easily and had a friendly disposition, she also connected with fans. Privately, she was discreet, avoiding the spotlight and politely declining interview requests. She also wasn't afraid to tell Tiger when she thought he was out of line or when he needed to do things that he would have preferred to avoid, such as talking to fans or engaging with the press. "She was good for Tiger," said Alicia O'Mara. If she didn't agree with something he said, she would politely say, "I see it this way." He had so many years of everybody telling him yes. When you're a celebrity, people tell you what you want to hear. She wasn't that kind of person. In one sense, Jagoda was similar to Tiger's first love, Dina Gravel. Both women truly loved Tiger, but neither of them cared much for the lifestyle that came with his excessive fame. As he had with Gravel, Tiger shared parts of himself with Jagoda and had moments of intimacy. But there were aspects of his life that he kept from her, including the fact that he was getting more and more attention from other women. As a result, he was gaining confidence, and his expectations of who he wanted on his arm were changing. Once the relationship was over, Tiger never looked back. 2 things coincided with Joanna Jagoda's departure from Tiger's side. He failed to win any of the first 6 tournaments he entered in 2001, and he became a lot surlier, especially toward the press. He was in a particularly foul mood with the media prior to the start of the Bay Hill Invitational in mid-March, if for no other reason than that he was sick and tired of any suggestion of a slump. For the most part, the golf press danced around the word, but Tiger knew what everyone was thinking and went out of his way to remind the writers that his scoring average through the first 6 tournaments in 2001 was actually better than it had been in 2000 when he was winning tournament after tournament. Talk of a slump, he made clear, was just idiotic. "Does it bug you that we make it a storyline? My God, he's gone 6 events and he hasn't won. What's wrong with the guy?" asked one reporter. "Well, it's annoying because of the fact that if you think that way, then you really don't understand the game of golf," Tiger said. In his mind, one of those lacking such understanding was Jimmy Roberts, his former friend and now, in Tiger's eyes, foe, ever since the unwelcome question about Tiger's cursing on live television during the U.S. Open in 2000. A week before Tiger got to Bay Hill, Roberts had done a piece for NBC essentially defending Woods, artfully equating Tiger's slump to the Beatles not having a number one record for a few months. That Roberts was supporting him made no difference to Tiger. He hated having the word slump applied to him in any context. So when Roberts asked Woods if, in effect, he was a victim of his own success, Woods gave him essentially the same "you don't understand the game of golf" answer, only it wasn't an insult in the isolated confines of a press tent. The exchange took place in front of millions of viewers on national television. To put it mildly, Roberts was none too pleased. "You're not even listening," he thought. "You don't even get it." Tiger won at Bay Hill, but he wasn't about to let go of his animus toward the media, especially toward Roberts. The next week, at the Players' Championship, Woods had another tense exchange with Roberts following an early round. Golf World columnist John Hawkins was standing nearby. "Don't worry, dude," Hawkins told Roberts from across the rope line. "You keep on asking those good questions." Roberts took one look at Hawkins and told him what he thought of him and the rest of the fawning reporters who had long treated Woods as though he were labeled "Handle with Care." "Let me ask you something," he said. "When the fuck are you guys going to start asking him those good questions?" Hawkins paused and looked down before responding. "Good point," he said. "Because we've all been kissing his ass for years now, and we still don't get anything interesting." On Monday, after taking possession of the Players' Championship trophy in the rain-delayed event, Woods once again faced Roberts, this time on the 18th green. Expressing congratulations, Roberts attempted a generic question. "Some slump," Tiger said, completely ignoring what Roberts was saying. Roberts tried again, but Tiger cut him off. "Means the slump is over," he said. Moments later, with Roberts in mid-sentence, Woods walked off, leaving Roberts standing alone on live television. Weeks later, Roberts approached Tiger privately in hopes of having a man-to-man talk to resolve any misunderstandings. But Woods brushed him off. He wanted nothing to do with Roberts. "I've thought a lot about him over the years because we've had some serious ups and downs," Roberts said in 2016. "There's more fuck you in Tiger Woods than in any athlete I've ever covered. In those days, it felt like a one-way street with him. He demanded respect but wasn't willing to offer any in return. He burns with hate toward people that he feels have wronged him or are not on his side." With the slump talk officially dispatched in the most ignominious manner, the 2001 storyline shifted to a gentler and more familiar terrain, the Masters. Would Woods be able to make it four majors in a row? If so, would that qualify as a Grand Slam, despite the fact that they were not won in a single calendar year? Woods made it clear that if he held all four major championship trophies at the same time, the media could call it whatever it wanted, Grand Slam, Tiger Slam, or some other slam. That was his answer. At Augusta, it's the back nine on Sunday where the tournament often divides. By the 18th tee, Woods had pushed Phil Mickelson aside and was one stroke clear of David Duval, who had torn up the course earlier with seven birdies in the first 10 holes. On the green in two, Woods was 12 feet from a two-putt par and carving his name deeper into the history of the game. Instead, he dropped the putt for birdie. Then he walked to the side green and buried his face in his hands. "I just started thinking, you know, I don't have any more shots to play. I'm done. I won the Masters," he said afterward. "It was just a weird feeling because when you're focused so hard on each and every shot, you kind of forget everything else. When I didn't have any more shots to play, I started to realize what I had done, and I started getting a little emotional." With his Masters win, he simultaneously possessed the four most prestigious trophies in golf, the U.S. Open, the British Open, the PGA Championship, and the Masters, and proudly displayed them on the mantle above the fireplace in his home. There had never been a human being on the planet who had won all four tournaments in succession. Soon after winning his second Masters, Woods was back on the range at Isleworth with O'Meara. While they practiced, Tiger chose to voice one of his favorite complaints, his loss of privacy. "You whine all the time about wanting privacy," O'Meara told him. "You gave all that up." Woods didn't want to hear it, but O'Meara wasn't about to let up on his friend. "You're one of the most famous people in the world," he continued. "People feel like they own a part of you. That's the price to be paid." Woods said nothing. "Now, I can help you with that," O'Meara said. "You can?" Woods asked. "Walk away," O'Meara said. "Just walk away. Give it all up. Take your money and run." But Woods knew that would mean walking away from the one thing that gave meaning to his life, symbolized by the shiny trophies that decorated his home. At 24, he already had five majors in his pocket, a milestone that Nicklaus didn't achieve until he was 26. Woods wasn't about to give up the fame either. As much as he hated being a public figure, he loved what the status afforded him. The hip Nike commercials, the American Express Centurion black card in his wallet, the Rolex on his wrist, the luxury home in Florida, the bachelor pad in Newport Beach, private planes, limousines, and security guards, his face on Wheaties boxes, billboards, and magazine covers throughout the world. The adulation was intoxicating, yet he was inescapably lonely. After the round, Tiger invited O'Meara over to his place. He wanted to show him the latest addition to his mantle. O'Meara watched as Tiger spent time taking pictures and lining up the glittering symbols just so. In a way, they were his best friends, the objects he'd devoted his life to acquiring. Joanne and Jagoda had treasured the trophies almost as much as Tiger did. But since she was out of the picture, there was no longer anyone special for him to share his successes with. But that was about to change. Chapter 20. In the Bubble. As Tiger's private plane made its descent into Las Vegas in the dark, the cluster of new mega resorts below came into view. The Mirage, Bellagio, Luxor, Mandalay Bay, the Venetian. Their shimmering lights seemed to be winking at him. For Tiger, Vegas had become a familiar place, a home away from home. He frequently went there to work with Butch Harmon, who had relocated his golf school to nearby Henderson. Tiger's trainer, Keith Clevin, an acquaintance from his Stanford days who was helping him build up his endurance, strength, flexibility, and speed, also lived there. But by the summer of 2001, Woods' primary purpose for going to the desert was to escape. His destination of choice was the MGM Grand, and he had a system that enabled him to get there without detection. It helped that Tiger never traveled with a huge entourage. Upon arrival, he would step from his private plane into a limo that delivered him to the mansion, an ultra-exclusive Italian-themed enclave of 29 villas tucked behind the MGM. Using a secluded alley entrance, Tiger would duck into an elevator that took him to a private floor, where his luxury suite awaited. Once inside, he could stay for days, and no one in the outside world would know he was there. Personal VIP host was at his service, ready to deliver most anything upon request. Fine cuisine, corner table, endless rounds of free drinks, exotic women, and most of all, absolute discretion. That's what made Vegas so attractive. It was his private playground, a place where he could indulge without fear of scrutiny, what locals called being in the bubble. When it opened in the spring of 1999, the mansion was billed as an invitation-only high roller's paradise, promising beyond attentive service and absolute privacy. It was just what Tiger craved, and he had no trouble gaining access to it. Villas were doled out like 4-carat diamonds, reserved for whales, casino speak for gamblers with credit lines of $100,000 and above. Tiger wasted little time becoming a whale. He'd always been a numbers guy, and he easily took to gambling in the late 90s when he started betting $100 a hand at blackjack and established a $25,000 credit limit that steadily increased over time. After a few years, Woods would routinely play $20,000 per hand, often on two or more hands at a time. His credit line at MGM reached $1 million. Only about 100 gamblers in the country had that kind of limit. Unlike a lot of celebrities who went to casinos to party, Tiger approached gambling the way he approached golf. He was there to win, and he often did. Industry insiders in Vegas referred to Tiger as a sharp, meaning he took a very smart, calculated approach to his bets and consistently won more than he lost. He thought nothing of walking away with $500,000 in winnings and didn't chase big losses. Tiger had gotten his first taste of the town as a high school recruit who was seriously considering enrolling at UNLV, but he'd been a geek then and not about to dabble in the city's pleasures. A few years later, he celebrated his 21st birthday at the MGM, and he was much more experienced in the ways of the world by that point. But it wasn't until NBA superstars Charles Barkley and Michael Jordan entered the picture that Tiger's eyes were really open to what Sin City had to offer a world-class athlete. Tiger met Barkley in Orlando in 1996 when the two of them played golf together for the first time. Barkley was 12 years older than Tiger, but they became fast friends, often hanging out together at casino resorts. Barkley taught Tiger to loosen up and enjoy the fruits of celebrity. "I would always say, it doesn't do any good to be Tiger Woods if you're not going to fucking enjoy being Tiger Woods," said Barkley. "Part of being great is you have to enjoy it." Tiger didn't need much convincing, but he didn't know how to go about doing it. He simply lacked the requisite set of social skills. On top of being intensely introverted, Tiger had spent most of his life within the protective cocoon built by his parents. His adolescent years were so tightly controlled that he was afforded few opportunities to experience life outside of golf and school. In the rare instances where he dared to break the rules set by his parents, he paid for it. "Mom beat the hell out of my ass," Tiger once told a reporter. I've still got the handprints. The expectations in that house and the pressure in that house were just so intense, said one of Tiger's best friends from that time. I felt sorry for him. One result of the way he was raised was that Tiger never disobeyed. He was determined not to do anything that might tarnish the gold-plated image that his parents had worked so hard to cultivate. Earl in particular had hyped his character so much that Tiger feared getting caught doing anything questionable. Now a dozen major corporations had constructed endorsement campaigns around Tiger's clean-cut reputation. Meeting Charles Barkley in 1996 was like finding a long-lost older brother who initiated him into a different side of life. In some ways, Sir Charles was a perfect role model. He was beloved everywhere he went, but especially in Vegas. A big-time gambler, Barkley had a reputation for handing out hefty tips that endeared him to the bellmen, valets, bartenders, and caddies. He talked to all of them as if they were his friends. Michael Jordan provided an entirely different example. Tiger initially met Jordan in passing, running into him numerous times right after he turned pro. But the first time they spent any quality time together was in 1997. After attending a Bulls game at the United Center, Woods sped off with Jordan in his Porsche to Lake Michigan. That night, they spent hours on a luxury casino boat. It was the beginning of a relationship that was cemented by their mutual love of golf and gambling. Despite stern warnings from his then-attorney, John Merchant, Tiger started calling Jordan a couple of times a week for advice. "I guess he looks at me as kind of a big brother," Jordan said at the time. "He's got a lot to deal with. He's 22 years old, but people want to project him to be older. Just because he hits the ball 9 miles and wins the Masters by 12 strokes, he's supposed to have all the answers. He's supposed to be perfect. That's not fair." One of the areas where Jordan exerted some influence early on was Tiger's natural inclination towards solitude. "His first instinct at being in the spotlight was to become a recluse," Jordan said. "Well, that's wrong. Believe me, I know. You can't just go to the golf course and when you're done, go back and lock yourself in your hotel room. I've been there. It's miserable. You can't just stare at the TV. You lose your sense of society. You're not living life." Perhaps it was inevitable that Tiger would turn to Jordan. There was no other athlete alive who had experienced the same level of fame. The two of them essentially belonged to their own exclusive club. As a result, Jordan exercised considerable influence over Tiger's attitude toward fame, women, and power. "We call each other brothers because Michael is like the big brother," Woods said. "I'm like the little brother. To be able to go to a person like that who has been through it all and has come out of it just as clean as can be, that's the person you want to talk to. And on top of that, he's one great guy." Tiger's view of Jordan wasn't universally shared by the working class in Vegas. They found him to be an aloof, arrogant star who embraced the word entitled with a capital E. He didn't have to travel far to find stories of Jordan's barely tipping or altogether stiffing caddies, locker room attendants, card dealers, and bartenders, or if he's driving his tricked-out North Carolina blue golf cart down the middle of a fairway at Shadow Creek, music blaring as he blew by one foursome after another while yelling, "Hurry the fuck up! You guys are slow as fuck!" In the words of one Vegas insider, a complete fucking asshole. But Vegas being Vegas, Jordan's boorish behavior never leaked out. "Everybody protected Michael back then because he was the best ever," said one Vegas source. "Nobody ever talked about Michael. Nobody ever told on Michael. Everybody was scared of Michael, and Tiger learned from him." By the time Jordan entered the picture, Tiger's attitudes toward money and people were already well ingrained. Even when a meal was free, and it almost always was, Tiger rarely left a decent tip. And as far as tipping doormen, bellmen, and valets, it got to the point where PGA Tour representatives were often quietly leaving $100 tips on Tiger's behalf with locker room attendants at tour stops to keep his parsimonious ways out of the press. For Tiger, even the most basic human civilities, a simple hello or thank you, routinely went missing from his vocabulary. A nod was too much to expect. Tiger didn't learn all of this behavior from Jordan. If anything, this sense of entitlement had been originally authored by Earl. Tiger's relationship with Jordan simply provided reinforcement. "When Tiger got famous, he got mean," said a former nightclub owner. When it came to women, Tiger's head didn't turn easily, at least not when he was on the golf course. He was once asked by a writer how he managed to avoid getting distracted by the unusual number of golf bunnies behind the ropes at his tournaments. He replied that he didn't notice them, His focus, he said, was on getting his ball in the hole. Even when a young model who worked as a lap dancer stripped naked and ran onto the 18th green to dance in front of Tiger at the British Open in 2000, he remained locked in, prompting a Scottish police officer who took the woman into custody to remark, "Tiger didn't respond to her at all. His concentration is astounding." But that all changed at the British Open the following year when Tiger noticed a striking 21-year-old blonde nanny with fellow pro Jasper Parnevik and his wife Mia. Up to that moment, Phil Mickelson's wife, Amy, who had formerly been a cheerleader for the Phoenix Suns and who had appeared in the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, was generally considered the most striking woman on the PGA Tour. But the Parnevik's nanny was going to make everyone forget about Amy Mickelson. In a very brief encounter, Tiger said hello, and she introduced herself as Elin. Smitten, he was eager to learn more about her. Elin Maria Pernilla Nordegren was born in Stockholm on New Year's Day in 1980. Her identical twin, Josephine, was born minutes later. Elin and her sister were raised in the coastal town of Vaxholm. Their father, Thomas Nordegren, was one of Sweden's most accomplished journalists. Their mother, Barbro Holmberg, was a highly educated social worker. When Elin was six, her parents divorced. Her father eventually moved to Washington, D.C. to cover the White House for Swedish National Radio. Her mother went on to work for the Swedish government, where she rose to a cabinet-level position as Minister for Migration. When Elin was 19, she was contacted by Bingo Rimer, a prominent fashion photographer who did work for Scandinavian Playboy. Rimer, who fancied himself Sweden's answer to Hugh Hefner, had seen a candid photo of Elin and instantly thought she had the potential to be a top model. After tracking her down, he convinced her to sit for a couple of photo shoots. One of his pictures of her in a bikini ended up on the cover of the magazine Café Sport. But Elin had no real interest in modeling and instead enrolled at Lund University, one of Sweden's top schools, to study psychology. During the summer after her freshman year, she took a job at a clothing boutique in Stockholm, where a few weeks later, Mia Parnevik went shopping and encountered her. The Parneviks had four young children and were looking for a new nanny, and Mia was instantly struck by Elin's friendly nature and ease around kids. Shortly after that chance encounter in the boutique, Elin quit her summer job in Sweden and moved to Florida to be the Parneviks' nanny, taking up residence in the family's 3,000-square-foot guesthouse. The first time she accompanied the Parneviks to a tournament was to the 2001 British Open. Life-altering chance encounters were the norm for Elin Nordegren, but when she bumped into Tiger Woods in Scotland, she had no interest in a relationship with him. A short while later, he reached out through an intermediary and asked her out, but she found his approach odd and off-putting. Besides, she had a steady boyfriend back in Sweden and wanted nothing to do with a famous athlete. She wasn't about to be a trophy girlfriend. She turned him down. By this time, it was rare for anyone to say no to Tiger. The fact that Elin did said everything Tiger needed to know about her. "I resisted his courting for a long time," Elin once said. "I was not an easy catch." But Tiger persisted, regularly texting her and calling the house, sounding nervous whenever Jesper would answer the phone. Once he got to Nordegren, though, Tiger turned on the charm. He made her laugh and showed her a good time. She felt safe around him. By the fall, he had won her over, and they started seeing each other. Initially, it was all very hush-hush. Tiger didn't want anyone to know, at least not yet. When she started dating Tiger, it was like there was an unwritten agreement that she wouldn't say anything to anyone, a Tour insider said. She became like Greta Garbo. Publisher Larry Kirschbaum was getting concerned. Shortly after turning pro, Tiger had signed a $2 million contract with Warner Books to write an instructional book on golf and an autobiography later on. After waiting for 4 years for the first book, Kirschbaum invited Mark Steinberg to his office to make clear that he wanted Tiger's book out in time for Christmas 2001. It was the agent's first meeting with Kirschbaum, one of the most powerful people in publishing. When Steinberg stepped into his office, he immediately noticed some University of Michigan regalia prominently displayed on Kirschbaum's desk. "Don't tell me you're a Wolverine," Steinberg said. "Well, where are you from?" Kirschbaum snapped. "Slippery Rock College?" "I'm a fighting Illini," Steinberg said proudly. Without saying another word, Kirschbaum turned, knelt down, and started messing with the stereo he kept on the bottom shelf of his bookcase. His behavior puzzled Steinberg, but Kirschbaum had a plan. Well aware that Steinberg had played on the Illinois team that lost a heartbreaker to Michigan 83-81 in the Final Four in 1989, he played the victors, the most well-known fight song in history. As Steinberg cupped his ears, Kirschbaum cranked up the volume on what amounted to fingernails on a chalkboard for any Big Ten rival. "I can't take this anymore," Steinberg said. "I'm going. I'm leaving." They both had a big laugh, and Kirschbaum got what he wanted, a commitment from Steinberg to get Tiger to deliver. He suggested using Tiger's columns from Golf Digest as the basis for the book, and recommended that some of the editors there could interview Tiger to enhance the narrative. It all sounded good to Kirschbaum. By the summer of 2001, Steinberg had made sure that Tiger delivered, turning in his long-awaited book, How I Play Golf. At Steinberg's urging, Warner Books used an image of Tiger in his latest Nike gear on the cover. The book was slated for publication in the fall, but Kirschbaum faced a quandary after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Should he delay publication? The concern was that there might be little appetite for a golf book while the country was in mourning. But Kirschbaum ended up sticking with the publication date. On October 9, 2001, Tiger's book went on sale and became an instant bestseller, moving almost 1 million copies in hardback alone. His popularity was at an all-time high, and it seemed that everything he touched turned to gold. "We were in it for over $2 million for two books," Kirschbaum said. But it turned out to be cheap in the end because the instructional book was such a huge success. And Warner still had an autobiography from Tiger to look forward to down the road. At the end of December 2001, Nordegren returned to Stockholm for the holidays. While she was home, she went to see Bingo Reimer and told him about her budding romance with Tiger Woods. Reimer had become a confidant, and she let him know that she would soon need to have him release some images of her to the media, but only specific ones that she personally approved. While Elin was overseas, Tiger went to Vegas, where he remained for a VIP bash celebrating the opening of Light, an upscale nightclub inside Steve Wynn's Bellagio Hotel. Tiger's go-to guy at the mansion had set him up with an all-expenses-paid comp. Previously, Tiger had hung out with Barkley and Jordan at places like Drink or the bar at P.F. Chang's. Light, however, was a whole new scene, the kind of place that literally put the sin in Sin City. It catered to a young, hip crowd with money to burn and offered, for a $300 fee, premium white glove treatment and a chance to party with A-list stars. With little more than a nod, a VIP could have his host escort a woman from the dance floor and discreetly deliver her to his table. Light's runaway success spawned similar night spots such as Pure, Tao, and Jet, each trying to be more exclusive and seductive than the last. But the opening of Light marked the first time that the casino industry had embraced an upscale nightclub that catered to the rich and famous, and it quickly became Tiger's late-night destination of choice. "It was absolutely crazy, out of control," said one longtime Vegas insider who partied at the club alongside Woods. One night, not long after the grand opening, Tiger and another high-profile athlete had settled into their VIP table in a back corner just off the dance floor when they noticed a couple of attractive young women partying at a nearby table. A request was made, and the VIP host approached the ladies with the magic words, "Tiger Woods would like you at his table." The brunette and her blonde friend got up as if shot out of a cannon. Later, they accompanied Tiger and the other athlete up to a suite at the Bellagio, where the group stripped down and slipped into a hot tub. At one point, Woods took the brunette by the hand and led her out of the hot tub, avoiding the various bedrooms. He instead walked her straight into a closet and had his way with her in the dark. The rough nature of the encounter shocked the brunette. She left wondering why he couldn't have at least taken her to a bed. Starting in 1998, each year during the week of the Masters, Tiger stayed with Mark and Alicia O'Mara at the Augusta area home of Peggy Lewis. He liked it there for a number of reasons. It was out of the way and afforded great privacy. Plus, O'Mara always paid the rent. And when O'Mara failed to make the cut, he would leave town on Friday night, meaning Tiger had the place to himself for the remainder of the weekend. In 2002, Woods chose to stay at Lewis's place again. And this time, he brought Elin along. 2 weeks earlier, she had stepped into the limelight for the first time, quietly cheering him on at the Bay Hill Invitational in Orlando. But Tiger was still trying to keep a lid on their relationship, and Lewis's home provided the cover he was looking for. After O'Mara missed a cut and left town, Tiger and Elin were alone at Lewis's place. They didn't venture out, choosing instead to eat in and remain out of sight. On Saturday, Tiger woke up at 4:30 a.m., his focus squarely on the fact that he trailed the leader, Vijay Singh, by 6 strokes. He went out and shot a 66, blowing past Singh to take the lead at 11 under. Then, on Sunday, he fended off Singh and 3 of his closest rivals, Els, Garcia, and Mickelson, and for the 2nd straight year and the 3rd time in 6 years, won the Masters. The other players were reluctant to admit it, but they were intimidated by Tiger and the murderous way he went about knocking them off, one by one, in big tournaments. At age 26, Tiger had won 7 majors faster than anyone in history. Perhaps even more telling, he had never finished 2nd in a major, meaning that when he was in contention in the final round, he simply didn't lose. In contrast, Jack Nicklaus had 6 second-place finishes in a major championship by the time he was 26 years old. But this latest victory lacked the emotional exuberance of the 1997 win or the historical significance of that of 2001. This time it felt almost routine, as if he were just going about his business, systematically checking off another item on his growing list of achievements. The energetic fist pumping had been replaced by long, silent stares. At the press conference afterward, Tiger was asked, "Can you please share with us how you plan to celebrate and with whom tonight?" But Tiger had no intention of sharing his plans. "You know," he said, "right now I'm going to a dinner here, the champion's dinner. I think when I get home, I've got to pack up my suitcase and get ready for my flight, but I will celebrate. I'm not going to tell you how, but I will celebrate." It must have been some celebration, because the next day when Peggy Lewis returned to her home, it was a wreck. Shaving cream was smeared on the bedroom and bathroom walls. Plates with partially eaten food were left under Tiger's bed. The kitchen looked as though it had hosted a frat party. Lewis ended up staying in a hotel that night while a cleaning service restored her home. A few weeks later, she got her phone bill and discovered more than $100 worth of long-distance calls had been made to Sweden and England during the weekend of the Masters. Fed up, Lewis did something she'd never done. She placed a call to Tiger's office. It was bad enough that Tiger had never paid her for the use of her home or left her a tip, but what really upset her was his basic lack of respect and appreciation. Year after year, she would return home to find her personal property damaged or destroyed, none of which Tiger had apologized for or offered to replace. When Tiger's assistant got on the phone, Lewis unloaded. "He's not allowed in my house again," Lewis told her, launching into a list of grievances that ranged from small. One year she found her nicest white comforter covered in bloodstains and balled up in the corner of Tiger's room, to expensive. In 2001, she had to replace a brand new dining room table after someone, she suspected Earl Woods, had left cigarette burns all over the surface. When the O'Maras heard about the table incident, they purchased a new one for her. The only year Lewis's home hadn't been damaged while Tiger was in it was in 2000, the year Joanna Jagoda was with him. It was also the only year Lewis had received a thank you card. It read, "Thank you very much for sharing your lovely home. I hope to see you when I come back. Joanna." Not a word, however, from Tiger. "I asked him one time if we should send flowers," Tiger's assistant told Lewis. It was a little late for that. There had been Sunday nights when Lewis had to go to a hotel because Tiger was still in her house. It irritated her that in those instances, Tiger still didn't offer to pay her expenses. But it was the calls to Sweden that had pushed her over the edge. Tiger was the richest athlete in the world. Would it really be so difficult to leave behind some money and a note explaining they had used the phone? "Make a copy of the bill and send it to me," his assistant said. A few days later, Lewis received a bouquet of flowers from Tiger's office. Then, a couple of weeks after that, she received an envelope containing a photocopy of her phone bill and a check. The calls that Elin had made were highlighted in yellow. The check was for the exact amount of those calls and not a penny more. Tiger's inability to show gratitude, apologize, or express appreciation was rooted in his warped upbringing. His mother pampered him like a prince, and his father rarely uttered the words "thank you" or "I'm sorry." Tiger learned early and often that his needs were all that mattered. His unapologetically self-centered attitude was critical to his success in golf, but it had an utterly devastating impact on the way people perceived him. Sadly, Woods didn't seem to care about the latter part. It didn't matter that someone like Peggy Lewis would have adored him for life if he'd simply acknowledged and thanked her. Elin stood behind Tiger as he sat at a craps table at